Yes, he assumed that's on. Okay?
Yep.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's a great, yes. My name's John Horrigan. Thank you, Harriet. It's great to be here at the Marblehead Jewish Community Center to speak to the Marblehead Low Vision Group. This is the first day of fall, I regret to announce, and some people refer to this year, 2009, as a year without a summer. Well,
say that again. What do we have, 2 weeks?
Well, yes, right, that's, I counted 12 days of 85 degrees or over in late August, right? And they were marvelous days, and we didn't complain about that because we had such a cruddy spring and summer.
We have a spring.
Right. Well, today we're going to talk about the year without a summer of many years ago, almost 200 years ago. We're talking about the year without a summer in the year 1816. And I want to start off by quoting Adino Brackett. Quote, talks about the summer of 1816. And by the way, don't worry about what's up on the screen. If you can't see it, don't worry. You'll hear my voice. They'll be able to hear me all the way to Gloucester. This past summer and fall have been so cold and miserable that I have from despair kept no account of the weather. It could have been nothing but a repetition of frost and drought. Well, the year without a summer, it's been called many, many different monikers. One person called it 1800 and froze to death. Another one called it the cold summer. Still others called it the poverty year. Then the year without summer, the summerless year of 1816, and 1816 a near froze to death, or the year there was no summer. Now, we have to look at trends. I like to look at weather. Don Kent, do you remember that meteorologist? Well, as a boy, he told me, look to the sun and don't look to the sky if you want to know about the weather. And if we look, I like to look at it at a large 100-year, 500-year, and 1,000-year increments. And what we had is a medieval warm period, which took place in the early Middle Ages to the late Dark Ages, where temperatures were extraordinarily high. And the Little Ice Age began after a warm period during the Middle Ages. And the Little Ice Age, well, depending upon who you speak to, took place between the years 1350 and 1850. And again, it depends on who you're speaking to, but there were very cold temperatures measured worldwide, temperature anomalies, especially just prior to Columbus setting sail in 1492 to discover the New World. Well, thankfully, the weather was calm when Columbus set forth looking for the New World, because if he had run into hurricanes or unseasonable weather, we might have remained undiscovered for another 100 years, and our discoverers may have been Vikings, heaven forbid. But around the year 1300, warm summers stopped being dependable in Northern Europe. And three minima, you'll hear me talk about that today, began in the year 1650, 1770, and 1850. And if you look at it from a historical perspective, and when I mean minima, there was a lack of sunspots on the sun. And I'm going to explain all this, and I promise I won't get too technical on you. 1650, 1770, and 1850. Well, 1650, Boston had been discovered in 1630s. 1770, just before the American Revolution. And 1850, the heart of the Industrial Revolution, and just before the beginning of the Civil War. But the Little Ice Age brought colder winters to portions of Europe and North America. In the mid-17th century, glaciers in the Swiss Alps advanced, gradually engulfing farms and crushing entire villages. Now, we had a period known as the Maunder Minimum. And the Maunder Minimum resembled, it basically resembled, it took place from 1645 to 1717. And that was responsible for at least 70 years of abnormally cold weather in the Northern Hemisphere. And what I mean by minimum, there was a minimum of sunspots, okay? Now, you're going to hear me talk about sunspots. When there are sunspots on the sun is brighter, believe it or not. When there are no sunspots, the sun is dimmer. The Maunder Minimum interval is sandwiched within an even better known cool period known as the Little Ice Age, which lasted about the 14th through the 19th centuries. I think that this minimum could be due to a lack of compiled data, that there weren't a lot of scientists and astronomers in the early days of astronomy, not only observing the sun, but recording their observations. 1816 marked the midpoint of one of the sun's extended periods of low magnetic activity called the Dalton minimum, but it was a very active year for sunspots, the year 1816. And this particular minimum lasted from about 1790 to the 1820s. So you have three factors that can cause abnormal weather. One are a lack of sunspots. The second is the sun's movement throughout our solar system. Now, during the Dalton and the Maunder minima, the sun shifted its place in the solar system. It's something that it does every 178 to 180 years. During this cycle, the sun moves its position around the solar system's center of mass. This is known as inertial solar motion. Scientists have not yet confirmed whether or not it affects the Earth's climate, but this is a direct possibility. So the sun wobbles throughout our solar system. And the wobbling sun is due to the gravitational pull of the planets, mostly Jupiter and Saturn. The sun performs a dance around the solar system's center of gravity, as I mentioned, inertial solar motion. And I promise I won't get technical after this. Bear with me. The sun moves around the solar system's center of mass, known as the barycenter, in cycles that repeat themselves every 178 to 180 years. Important barycenter shifts took place in 1632, that's when Boston was discovered, 1811, the War of 1812, and in 1919. These shifts precede some of the weakest sunspot activity periods ever recorded. So the Maunder minimum was 1645 to 1715, and the Dalton minimum from 1795 to 1823. Right now we are in a minimum period, and that's why this is so pertinent. So the question is, could the movement of the sun in our solar system impact weather as distances to the Earth increases or decreases? Now, sunlight. Sunlight may be recorded using the sunshine recorder or a pyranometer or a pyroheliometer. The World Meteorological Organization defines sunshine as direct irradiance from the sun measured on the ground of at least 120 watts per square meter. Direct sunlight brings infrared, visible, and ultraviolet light. And bright sunlight provides luminance of approximately 100,000 candles per square meter of surface. That's bright. So sunlight is a key factor in photosynthesis, which is a process crucially important for life on Earth. And here's the hard one, and bear with me. It's called solar irradiance, and I'm not a technical guy. Irradiance, radiant emittance, and radiant excedence are radiometry terms for the power per unit area of electromagnetic radiation at a surface. Irradiance is used when the electromagnetic radiation is incident on the surface. Radiant excedence or radiant emittance is used when the radiation is emerging from the surface. And I have to tell you, my friends, I have absolutely no idea what that means. So, if we look at sunspots, well, sunspot populations quickly rise and more slowly fall on an irregular cycle about 11 years, every 11 years. Over the last decades, the sun has had a markedly high average level of sunspot activity. It was last similarly active over 8,000 years ago. So in these past few decades, the 50s, the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was an exorbitant amount of sunspots until we get late into this decade of the 21st century, and then they drop off dramatically. In fact, there's no sunspots, and this is what concerns me. In 2008 and 2009, sunspot activity dropped off dramatically. So we're waiting for what's known as solar cycle 24 to begin. And again, these solar cycles last 11 years. A history of solar observation. Good morning, come on in. Apparent references to sunspots were made by Chinese astronomers in 28 BC, who probably could see the largest sunspot groups when the sun's glare was filtered by wind-borne dust from the various Central Asian deserts. A large sunspot was also seen at the time of Charlemagne's death in AD 813. Sunspot activity in the year 1129 was described by John of Worcester of Great Britain Averroes, another astronomer, also provided a description of sunspots in the 12th century. Sunspots are manifestations of solar magnetic activity. In general, the more sunspots there are, the more active the sun is. Ironically, the sun is usually brighter when a large number of sunspots mar its visible surface. So, early incorrect scientific deductions regarding sunspots were corrected and explained by Galileo Galilei around 1612. They were first observed telescopically in late 1610 by the English astronomer Thomas Harriot and Frisian astronomers Johannes and David Fabricius, who published a description of sunspots in June of 1611. At the latter time, Galileo had been showing sunspots to astronomers in Rome, and Christoph Scheiner had probably been observing the spots for 2 or 3 months. Now, Galileo Galilei was born in 1564 and died in 1642. He observed sunspots from Padua, Italy in 1610. He supported Copernicus's view of a heliocentric solar system. This got him into trouble with the Catholic Church and Pope Urban VIII and led to a house arrest for the rest of his life after a publicized Roman Inquisition. He observed the surface of the sun at dusk through his telescope when mist had obscured the glare. He observed dark spots on its surface and applied a rotation rate of the sun of 25 days. Now, one thing to remember is Galileo never went blind due to solar observations. He contracted cataracts and glaucoma in his early 70s. Another important astronomer regarding the sun is William Herschel. He lived from 1738 through 1832. Herschel was the man who discovered Uranus, the planet, on March 13, 1781. He later discovered two moons of Saturn and two moons of Uranus. He also compiled an extensive catalog of nebulae, which are gaseous clouds in the universe, and theorized on binary star systems, which are double stars that rotate around each other and revolve around each other. He also coined the term asteroid and discovered infrared radiation. And he was the first to claim that the sun had an atmosphere, but he also claimed that it was full of living creatures, and this took place on December 18, 1795. So let's move forward now a century to the great solar flare of 1859. This is the greatest magnetic solar flare ever recorded in modern history. It happened on 11:18 a.m. on the cloudless morning of Thursday, September 1st, 1859, when a 33-year-old named Richard Carrington, widely acknowledged to be one of England's foremost solar astronomers, sketched some wild magnetic activity on the surface of the sun. Just before dawn the next day, September 2nd, 1859, skies all over planet Earth erupted in red, green, and purple auroras so brilliant that newspapers could be read as easily as in daylight. Telegraph systems worldwide went haywire as spark discharges shocked the operators and set the telegraph paper on fire. Even when telegraphers disconnected the batteries powering the lines, aurora-induced electric currents in the wires still allowed messages to be transmitted. This was a dandy, as they say, a huge solar flare. Now, solar surface activity impacts Earth's weather and climatology. The explosion in 1859 produced not only a surge of visible light, but also a mammoth cloud of charged particles and detached magnetic loops called a coronal mass ejection, or a CME, and hurled that cloud directly towards Earth. The next morning, when the CME arrived, it crashed into the Earth's magnetic field, causing the global bubble of magnetism that surrounds our planet to shake and quiver. Researchers call this a geomagnetic storm, and rapidly moving fields induced enormous electric currents that surged through telegraph lines and disrupted communications. So can you imagine if that happened today? It would knock out satellites. All of my equipment here that I'm using would knock out. You wouldn't even be able to use the telephone. And in fact, I'm going to talk about in just a moment, one happened in 2003 that was just as large, but the Earth happened to be turned away. The solar wind actually guided the flare away from Earth and did minimal destruction. So we got lucky. But anyways, in 1859, in that early September day, in the Rocky Mountains, the auroras were so bright that the glow awoke gold miners because they thought it was daylight, and they began to prepare their breakfast. There were severe solar geomagnetic storms in 1921, 1960, and two in this decade, 2001 and 2003. Now, we've had some really blank years, okay? Blank sun years where there aren't many sunspots. And let me tell you, astronomers who count sunspots have announced that last year, 2008, is now the blankest year of the space age. And here's the troubling part. As of September 19, 2009, that's a couple of days ago, the sun had been blank, i.e. it had no visible sunspots, on 211 days of this year. To find a year with more blank suns, you have to go back to 1954, 3 years before the launch of Sputnik, when the sun was blank 241 times. 2009 should surpass 2008 with blank sun days. In fact, we are on course to break the record in 1954. Radio telescopes are recording what they call the dimmest radio sun since 1955. So magnetic discharges are not even being heard on Earth through radio telescopes. So the 2009 total reads 211 spotless days. That's 81%. Since the year 2004, we've had 722 days with a typical solar minimum of 485 days. So this is leading to be one of the blankest years of the last half century.
You're telling us.
Yep. Yep. So, what happens in the spring of 1816? Well, the Dalton and Maunder minima, which I explained earlier, were extended periods of very weak solar activity spanning about 25 years and 70 years, respectively. Records from these periods show far fewer sunspots than normal, meaning that the sun's magnetic activity was very weak during those years. Even though the sun is covered by relatively few dark sunspots when it is not magnetically active, it also has fewer bright regions known as plages and faculae. Sustained periods of weak magnetic activity make the sun slightly dimmer, so Earth receives less solar light energy. And the years 1812 to 1815 were nearly spotless. But the year 1816 had a rash of sunspots in the spring. And this, coupled with what I'm going to describe in just a second with volcanic activity, caused the weather to go haywire. So the sunspots of 1816, well, they were seen with the naked eye in the daytime by thousands of people for several days. Now, I'm not recommending for anybody to look into the sun, but at sunset, when the sun is low on the horizon, people could see the sunspots. And there were two major periods in 1816. One began on May 3rd and ran through May 10th, 1816, and again on June 11th, 1816. Many attributed the dank weather in 1816 to lessening the amount of sunlight that was reaching the Earth, which was, of course, the opposite result. Here's a poem for you. All ye who tell why stars do wink, come ease my fears. What means the spot that folks may think so strange appears? As if within this ball of fire some hole were dug, or something black had settled there, like any old bug. And that was in the Connecticut Herald in May of 1816. So enough of sunspots and the sun moving throughout our solar system. Now, the real culprit. Major volcanic eruptions. Well, let's look at the major volcanic eruptions first in the late 18th century. Mount St. Helens in Oregon blew in the late 1700s. Mount Hood lava dome blew in the late 18th century. In Laki, Iceland, in June of 1783, that volcano blew and caused major worldwide climatic change. And Mount Rainier in the 1790s. You know, I went out to Mount Rainier a couple of months ago, and I was explaining to the people that run the park about this volcanic eruption, and nobody could tell me, give me any data, and I had to show it to them on the internet. Hey, they're young kids. So this Laki haze that I mentioned, it took place in 1783 through 1784, and this is a bit of a precursor to the year without a summer in 1816. What happened was a huge volcanic eruption took place in Iceland, and it spread throughout all of Europe, moving to the east, and it caused destruction, death, starvation, and crop failure. Now, it's called Lakagígar, Iceland, and it erupted before in 934 to 940 AD, and again on June 8th, 1783, and throughout the year 1784. 120 million tons of sulfur dioxide were emitted, killing plants, livestock, and people, and causing severe weather around the world. In North America, the winter of 1784 was the longest and one of the coldest on record. Record cold beset New England, snowfall fell in New Jersey, the longest freezing of the Chesapeake Bay happened in that year, and there was ice skating in Charleston Harbor. In fact, a huge snowstorm hit the South. The Mississippi River froze at New Orleans, and there was an ice floe in the Gulf of Mexico. That's cold. But it was our friend Benjamin Franklin who first proposed in 1784 that the poor weather could be attributed to a volcanic eruption in Iceland. Quote, "During several of the summer months of the year 1783, when the effect of the sun's rays to heat the earth in these northern regions should have been greater, there existed a constant fog over all of Europe and a great part of North America. This fog was of a permanent nature, it was dry, and the rays of the sun seemed to have little effect towards dissipating it, and as they easily do a moist fog arising from the water, they were indeed rendered so faint in passing through it that when collected in the focus of a burning glass, they would scarce kindle brown paper. The cause, so in other words, you couldn't even use a magnifying glass to light paper on fire. Now the cause of this universal fog, he says, is not yet ascertained, or whether it was the vast quantity of smoke, long continuing, to issue during the summer from Iceland, and that other volcanoes which arose out of the sea near that island, which smoke might be spread by various winds over the northern part of the world, is yet uncertain." Absolutely brilliant introduction by Benjamin Franklin. If you look at the great thinkers throughout time, you've got Galileo, okay, and Copernicus. You've got Da Vinci, and you've got Ben Franklin. Brilliant man. So what about volcanic winters? And what I mean by that is when you have climate changing and going much, much colder than it would in normal years. Well, we know through geology and archaeology we can take soil samples and look at tree rings, and we can deduce that in 1628 to 1626 before Christ, B.C., there were climate disturbances, usually attributed to the Minoan eruption of the island of Santorini. Some people attribute this to the parting of the Red Sea due to a tsunami allowing Moses to cross the Red Sea and lead the Israelites to safety. Lake Taupo's Hatipi eruption took place in the year 180 A.D., and there was extreme weather in Europe in 535 and 536 A.D. We also know that the Great Famine of 1315 to 1317 in Russia was attributed to Kaharoa in New Zealand, the volcano there. And also in 1452 and 1453, there was a submarine volcano called Kauai that erupted. In 1600, Huey Napatina erupted, causing a famine in Russia again from 1601 to 1603. And in 1883, a volcano known as Krakatoa, more than 36,600 people died. It caused 5 years of cold weather all over the earth, including the 1888 blizzards, the Children's Blizzard of the Northwest, and a paralyzing blizzard that struck New York City in 1888. And of course, recently, Mount Pinatubo, which caused cooler than average temperatures worldwide 1991 through 1993, and some spectacular sunsets. Mount Tambora now, which is known as a stratovolcano in Sumbawa, Indonesia, became highly active in the year 1812, and it erupted on April 10th and April 11th, 1815. And this is the precursor to the year without a summer. So Mount Tambora is 57,000 years old, and it blew its top. We know that there are ancient eruptions in Mount Tambora in Indonesia in 3910 BC, a long time ago, 3050 BC, and 740 AD, and we know that the climate changed in those years. But this first eruption took place on April 5th, 1815, and the thunder from the eruption was heard from 250 miles away. The major blast on April 10th was heard from 1,600 miles away and thought to be the sound of firing cannonade. About 7 o'clock at night, on April 10th, 1815, the eruptions intensified. Three columns of flame rose up and merged, and the whole mountain was turned into a flowing mass of what was called liquid fire. Pumice stones of up to 8 inches in diameter started to rain down at approximately 8 o'clock that night, followed by ash at around 9 to 10 o'clock that night. You get hit with one of those stones, it's going to hurt. You won't remember it. Hot pyroclastic flows, which are hot clouds of gas and ash that flow down the sides of volcanoes after an eruption, they cascaded down the mountain to the sea on all sides of the peninsula, wiping out the village of Tambora, Indonesia. Loud explosions were heard until the next evening. The ash veil had spread as far as West Java and South Sulawesi. This eruption was four times larger than Krakatoa in 1883. And this is what British explorer Sir Thomas Raffles says. The noise was, in the first instant, almost universally attributed to distant cannons, so much so that a detachment of troops were marched from Jakarta in the expectation that a neighboring post was being attacked. And along the coast, boats were in two instances dispatched in quest of a supposed ship in distress. So they send out armies. They think there's a battle going on. Pitch darkness was observed as far away as 370 miles from the mountain summit for up to 2 days. Pyroclastic flows spread at least 12 miles from the summit. All vegetation on the island was destroyed. Uprooted trees mixed with pumice ash washed into the sea and formed rafts of up to 3 miles across. Some of these rafts were found in India. So you're talking rafts of trees 3 miles across. Clouds of thick ash still covered the summit on April 23rd. Explosions on the volcano ceased on July 15th, 1815, although smoke emissions were still observed as late as the 23rd of August. Flames and rumbling aftershocks were reported in August of 1819, 4 years after this event. A modern-sized tsunami struck the shores of various islands in the Indonesian archipelago on April 10th with a height of up to 13 feet in Sangar at around 10 p.m. And we all know about the tsunami that hit in Indonesia in Christmas Eve of 2004 and killed all those people. Well, a tsunami of 3 to 6 feet in height was reported in Basuki, East Java, before midnight, and another one 6.5 feet in height in the Molucca Islands. The eruption column reached the stratosphere, which is an altitude of more than 140,000 feet. The coarser ash particles fell 1 to 2 weeks after the eruptions, but the finer ash particles stayed aloft in the atmosphere from a few months up to a few years at an altitude of 33,000 to 100,000 feet. Longitudinal winds spread these fine particles around the globe, creating optical phenomena, in other words, brilliant sunsets and auroras. Prolonged and brilliantly colored sunsets and twilights were frequently seen in London, England between June 28th and July 2nd, 1815, and again on September 3rd and October 7th, 1815. The glow of the twilight sky typically appeared orange or red near the horizon with purple and pink hues above. About 75,000 people died due to this volcanic eruption. The estimated number of deaths varies depending on the source. 10,000 direct deaths were probably caused by the pyroclastic flows. They were covered with the ash, similar to what happened in Pompeii, 79 AD, where an entire village, people were found, women were found removing bread from the oven, another man sitting at a table with a fork in his hand as he was about to eat his dinner. They were frozen or burnt solid by the ash. On Sumbawa Island in Indonesia, there were 38,000 deaths alone due to starvation, and another 10,000 deaths occurred due to disease and hunger on Lombok Island. So in the vicinity immediately around the Mount Tambora, people died instantly and some later due to disease and starvation. Now, sulfur dioxide poured into the stratosphere, causing what's known as a global climate anomaly, or a GCA. In the spring and summer of 1816 now, a year later, a persistent dry fog was observed in the northeastern United States. The fog reddened and dimmed the sunlight such that sunspots were visible to the naked eye. So what were happening here is not only did you have a volcano go off, but the year 1816, all of a sudden the sun becomes active. And when sunspots become instantly active from a dormant period on the sun, that also causes weather to go haywire. And it makes the reaction of the weather, it exacerbates the problem of the weather. You can get extreme cold and extreme hot temperatures. Storms develop. But neither wind nor rainfall dispersed this dry fog. Average global temperatures decreased, about 0.7 to 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit, enough to cause significant agricultural problems around the globe. All you need is a decrease of 1 degree Fahrenheit, average, and you have problems growing plants. 1816 was the second coldest year in the Northern Hemisphere since AD 1400, and also after 1601 following the 1600 Huayna-Pitina eruption in Peru. The 1810s, that decade, are the coldest decade on record, a result of Tambora's 1815 eruption and other suspected eruptions somewhere between 1809 and 1814. With a cooler summer, parts of Europe experienced a stormier winter. This pattern of climate anomaly has been blamed for the severity of typhus epidemic in Southeast Europe and India and the Eastern Mediterranean between the years 1816 and 1819. So you have bad weather where you can't grow crops, you get health problems, starvation, disease perpetuates itself. Much livestock died in New England during the winter of 1816-1817. Cool temperatures and heavy rains resulted in failed harvests in the United Kingdom. Families in Wales traveled long distances as refugees begging for food. Famine was prevalent in North and Southwest Ireland following the failure of wheat, oat, and potato harvests. Now, mind you, this was a famine in Ireland in 1816 through 1819. The big famine, the Great Hunger, took place in the 1840s, which caused a migration to the United States. The crisis was so severe in Germany, where food prices rose sharply. Due to the unknown cause of the problems, again, they didn't have Benjamin Franklin around to tell them that it was due to a volcano. They didn't know what was happening. There were demonstrations in front of grain markets and bakeries, followed by riots, arson, and looting, and this took place in many European cities. It was the worst famine of the 19th century. But there are other large volcanic eruptions that took place during the same time frame. So before Tambora, and I call them Tambora's little helpers, in 1812, La Soufriere on the island of St. Vincent in the Caribbean went off. Also, in 1812, volcano Awu on the Sangihe Islands in Indonesia went off. In 1813, on Ryukyu Islands in Japan, volcanic eruption. 1814, Mayon in the Philippines erupted. So the results, these other eruptions had already built up a substantial amount of atmospheric dust prior to the eruption of Mount Tambora, the largest in 1,600 years. As is common, following a massive volcanic eruption, temperatures fell worldwide because less sunlight passed through the atmosphere. So 1816 and near froze to death. Historian John Post has called this the last great subsistence crisis in the Western world. The unusual climatic aberrations of 1816 had the greatest effect on the northeastern United States, right here in New England, the Canadian Maritimes, Newfoundland, and northern Europe. Typically, the late spring and summer of the northeastern United States and southeastern Canada are relatively stable. Temperatures, the average of both day and night, average about 68 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit, and they rarely fall below 41 degrees Fahrenheit. Summer snow is an extreme rarity, though May snow flurries sometimes occur. In China, I believe May, we had a May snow flurry in 1977, if I'm not correct. In China, the cold weather killed trees, rice crops, and even water buffalo, especially in northern China. Floods destroyed many remaining crops. Mount Tambora's eruption disrupted China's monsoon season, resulting in overwhelming floods in the Yangtze River Valley in 1816. So this is worldwide, and it caused devastation. In India, the delayed summer monsoon caused late torrential rains that aggravated the spread of cholera from a region near the River Ganges in Bengal to as far as Moscow in Russia. In May 1816, frost killed off most of the crops that had been planted in New England. In June, two large snowstorms in eastern Canada and in New England resulted in many human deaths. Nearly a foot of snow was observed in Quebec City in early June, with consequent additional loss of crops. The result was regional malnutrition, starvation, epidemic, and increased mortality. In short, that's what a famine is. In July and August 1816, lake and river ice were observed as far south as Pennsylvania. Rapid, dramatic temperature swings were common, with temperatures sometimes reverting from normal or above normal summer temperatures as high as 95 degrees Fahrenheit, and then to near freezing within hours. So you had extreme fluctuations, extreme differentials. Even though farmers south of New England did succeed in bringing some crops to maturity, maize and other grain prices rose dramatically. And those areas suffering local crop failures had to deal with the lack of roads in the early 19th century, which prevented easy importation of bulky foodstuffs. So to get the relief food, the relief maize and grain to the affected areas was difficult. They had lousy roads. And just to couple that is, if you don't have grain to feed the livestock, livestock goes away, which pulls the carts. So in the ensuing bitter winter of 1817 now, when the thermometer dropped to 26 degrees Fahrenheit, the waters of New York's Upper Bay froze so hard that horse-drawn sleighs were driven across Buttermilk Channel from Brooklyn to Governor's Island. So New York Harbor freezes over. In eastern Switzerland, the summers of 1816 and 1817 were so cool that an ice dam formed below a tongue of the Gietro Glacier high on the Val de Bagnes. In spite of the efforts of the engineers to drain the growing lake, the ice dam collapsed catastrophically in June of 1818, causing hundreds of deaths. And this is odd, too. There were luminous or electrical snowstorms called thunder snow in Vermont in January and February of 1817, where a ball lightning shocked many people. Many New England farmers were wiped out, and tens of thousands struck out for the richer soil and better growing conditions of the upper Midwest, which was then the Northwest Territory. So, Tambora erupted in 1815. So why wasn't the summer of 1815, rather than the summer of 1816, the year without a summer? Well, the answer is simple. There's a time lag between a volcanic eruption and a change in weather patterns caused by the length of time needed for stratospheric winds to distribute the volcanic dust particles around the world. It takes time for that dust to get in the upper atmosphere. Europe, which was still recuperating from the Napoleonic Wars and the scourge of Napoleon, who just devastated Europe with wars, and, well, they suffered food shortages. Food riots broke out in Britain and France, and grain warehouses were looted. The violence was worse in landlocked Switzerland, where famine caused the government to declare a national emergency. Huge storms, abnormal rainfall with floodings of the major rivers of Europe, including the Rhine River, are attributed to the event, as was the frost setting in during early August of 1816. A BBC documentary using figures compiled in Switzerland estimated that fatality rates in 1816 were twice that of average years, giving an approximate European fatality total of 200,000 deaths. The lack of oats to feed horses may have inspired the German inventor Karl Drais to research new ways of horseless transportation, which led to the invention of the draisine or velocipede, which is the ancestor of the modern bicycle. Now, have anybody heard of J.M.W. Turner, the great painter? Well, high levels of ash in the atmosphere led to an unusually spectacular sunset period. This feature was celebrated in the paintings of J.M.W. Turner. It's been theorized that it was this that gave rise to the yellow tinge that's predominant in his paintings, such as the Chichester Canal, circa 1828. So here you have an artist who painted sunsets, and he's getting spectacular sunsets due to the dust particles aloft in the sky. The crop failures of the year without a summer forced the family of Joseph Smith to move from Sharon, Vermont to Palmyra, New York, precipitating a series of events culminating in the publication of the Book of Mormon and the founding of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He would later move west to Utah. The chemist Justus von Liebig, who had experienced the famine as a child in Darmstadt, Germany, later studied the nutrition of plants, and he was the one who introduced mineral fertilizers. Near Iceland, sea ice persisted into June of 1816. And the grapes in the Champagne district of the Verdun in France froze in the cold summer and never ripened. Vineyards across France suffered a similar fate. Only a few grapes ripened in the autumn months. The 1816 grape harvest of France was practically non-existent due to the cold summer. Without grape harvest, you have no wine.
And excuse me, John, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Could somebody walk me to the ladies' room, please?
Yeah.
Sure. I will. Okay. Sorry, John.
Ireland experienced persistent cold rain for 142 of 153 days in the summer. It rained that whole summer. In response to the food shortage caused by the year without a summer, the British government actually abolished income taxes in the year 1816. In January 1816, a blizzard of brown snow hit Hungary. Described as flesh-colored, the snow's unusual color was the result of mixing with the volcanic dust from Mount Tambora. In the spring of 1816, Italy experienced red and amber-colored snow. The food shortage in Canada aggravated a trade dispute over pemmican, which is a concentrate of meat, berries, and fat, between Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest Company. This triggered the June 1816 riot, known as the Battle of Seven Oaks, where 24 people died. In Madrid, Spain, temperatures were below 59 degrees Fahrenheit in July and August, unprecedented. In that autumn, the Catalan peaks of Montserrat and Montsenis were covered with snow, and the Llobregat River froze over. Now, what you get out of this in 1816 is a writing contest. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley. She was born in 1797 and died in 1851. She married a romantic poet-philosopher named Percy Bysshe Shelley in 1816. Unfortunately, she began her courtship with Percy Bysshe Shelley while he was still married, and his wife Harriet later committed suicide. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley's parents were political philosopher William Godwin, and her mother was the philosopher-feminist Mary Wollstonecraft. So when you look at the book that she's about to write, and she's only 18 and 19 years old, it's an astounding work, a brilliant work. But if you look at her heritage, she came from two brilliant parents. In 1816, the couple, Percy Bysshe and Mary Shelley, who had not yet married, spent a summer with their friend Lord Byron, author John William Polidori, and Claire Claremont, who was Byron's mistress, at the Via Diodati in the village of Cologne on Lake Geneva in Switzerland. Percy Shelley had rented Maison Chapuis nearby. Well, they arrived on May 14, 1816, where Mary called herself to people Mrs. Shelley, even though she wasn't. Lord Byron then joined them on the 25th of May. Well, they passed that wet summer writing and boating and talking late into the night. And as Mary said, she said, quote, "It proved to be a wet, ungenial summer, and incessant rain often confined us for days to the house." Well, amongst other subjects discussed, the conversation turned to the experiments of the 18th century natural philosopher and poet Erasmus Darwin, who was said to have animated dead matter, and to the feasibility of returning a corpse or assembled body parts to life. And here's the formation of the book Frankenstein. So they're sitting around a log fire one night at Byron's villa, and the company also amused themselves by reading German ghost stories, prompting Lord Byron to suggest that they each write their own supernatural tale. Shortly afterwards, in a waking dream, Mary Godwin conceived the idea for Frankenstein. Quote, "I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then, on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life, and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion. Frightful must it be, for supremely frightful would be the effect of any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world." And thus she began writing what she assumed would be a short story. With Percy Shelley's encouragement, she expanded this tale into her first novel, known as Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus. It was first published in 1818. She later described that summer in Switzerland as the moment when, quote, "When I first stepped out from childhood into life." Their friend John William Polidori, who also was in that writing contest, would write the classic novel The Vampire during that session. So, the poverty year in America, in New England, the summer of 1816 included some early June snows, cold nights in both July and August. The widespread frost at low-level sites around New England on the 8th and 9th of July and the damaging frosts on the 22nd of August from interior New England all the way south into North Carolina. There were droughts, too, and finally killing frosts in September, such as that of September 27, 1816 in New England. This all led to crop failures and food shortages and helped stimulate a move westwards the following year. People said they'd had it with the weather. We've heard that before. In both Connecticut and in parts of New York, frosts after April are very rare, but in 1816, frosts were recorded every month of the year. Summer temperatures were between slightly below average and very below average, from 5.5 degrees to 9 degrees below average, depending upon which source you choose to believe. The most severe cold snap came in early June and killed the vegetable crop in parts of New England, ruining some farmers. The worst of the weather was in northern New England, but conditions during the summer of 1816 were also summer-like at times. For example, a late June heat wave saw temperatures top 90 degrees between the 22nd and 24th of June, and temperatures were near normal for much of the first two-thirds of August. It should also be pointed out that since 1816, it has been just as cold or even colder in each of the summer months, but never in consecutive months. The most notorious part of the infamous summer of 1816 was the cold snap in early June. June began promising enough, and on the 5th of June, temperatures in New England climbed into the 88 degrees to 91 degrees Fahrenheit degree range. For example, just down the road in Salem, it reached 90 degrees Fahrenheit on June 5th. However, during the afternoon of June 5th, thundery showers broke out over New England, and later in the day, a cold front swept across the region, dragging cold air down from Canada in its wake. The next day, June 6th, was much colder. Some places were as much as 49 degrees Fahrenheit colder than the day before. And in parts of Vermont and in Boston, temperatures reached little more than 45 degrees. So you had 90 degrees in Boston on the 5th, 45 degrees the next day. Conditions turned colder during the next two or three days, and precipitation that fell became increasingly wintry in nature. So on June 7th, snow fell over the northern highlands of New England. Snow flurries fell in parts of Connecticut and Massachusetts. It snowed from being 92 degrees in Salem on the 5th of June to snowing in Salem 2 days later. It snowed in Newton and in Boston on Boston Common. And away from the coast, snow fell in June as far south as 42 degrees north. Danville, Vermont reported snowdrifts just over 34 inches high, almost 3 feet high, were reported. This is in June. Contemporary reports spoke of prolonged falls of snow, snow settling and lying for a couple of days and very windy weather at times. However, by June 10th and June 11th, conditions began to improve, although mornings were still frosty. By June 12th, 1816, temperatures were rather more normal and in the 36 degree than they were in the 36 degree to 49 degree temperature range. And they stayed there until the 22nd to the 24th, when something of a heat wave developed. During these 3 days of June 22nd, June 23rd, and June 24th, 1816, temperatures around New England topped 90 degrees Fahrenheit. On the 23rd, a high of 92 degrees was recorded at Waltham, Massachusetts, while on June 24th, in Salem, temperatures reached 99 degrees. The Boston area also reached the high 90s during that time. July 1816 was notable for a lack of warm nights, which it turns out are necessary in allowing corn to grow and ripen. Some of the coldest nights were on the 8th and 9th of July, when a light ground frost affected some areas, such as the upper Connecticut River Valley and in Middlebury, Windsor, and Williamstown in Vermont. July 1816 was also a very dry month, and drought began to affect the harvest in some parts of New England. So whereas some parts of New England got snow, others remained dry for the entire summer. So moving into August of 1816, temperatures were normal for the first two-thirds of the month and peaked in the low 90s on the 18th and 19th, while conditions remained dry. The passage of an active cold front on the 20th of August led to a cooling down and a couple of spells of frosty nights during the last third of the month, which wiped out crops in some parts of northern New England. Contemporary reports mentions that snow-covered mountains in August and the dry, cool conditions of late August persisted through September, which ended with a series of crop-killing frosts. So again, snow flurries were reported on Boston Common on June 7th, 1816, and also on that day, quote, in Newton, the ground was white with snow. So, and we're getting to our end here, the combined influences of the sun's changes in magnetism, a major volcanic eruption, where ash clouds and sulfur aerosols spewed by this volcano were widespread, chilling the climate of the northern hemisphere by blocking out the sunlight with gases and particles, and also, possibly even the wobbling of the sun's position, were responsible for famine, drought, and destructive snows and rains in the northern hemisphere in the year 1816. Diary entries and newspaper accounts abound of the unusual spring and summer in the northern hemisphere. I'm just going to read a couple and then we'll be done here. In Franconia, New Hampshire, 88-year-old physician Edward Holyoake, a weather genius and amateur astronomer, he was a meteorologist who kept detailed weather records for 80 years. So he's got some data. And he wrote on June 7th, "Exceedingly cold. Ground was frozen hard and squalls of snow throughout the day. Icicles 12 inches long in the shade at noonday. Sleet fell in the northeast United States and snow drifts remained 2 feet high in the late spring. Sheep froze to death in the meadows, and small birds were easily caught by reason of the cold or were found dead in the fields." Massachusetts physician William Bentley wrote in Waltham on June 12th, "In few seasons have we heard more bitter complaints against cold weather than since this June has come in, and there was frost measured in Waltham on July 8th. Others recorded killer droughts and a strange tepid dryness, that dry fog that I was speaking about, wafting in on the northwest winds. A vivid impression of that summer in the northeast United States appeared in verse, and I'll read it to you. The trees were all leafless. The mountains were brown. The face of the country was scathed with a frown. And bleak were the hills and the foliage sere, as had never been seen at that time of the year. A certain degree of normalcy returned for part of the summer. In some areas around the coast, the weather was bland and agreeable, if not humid. Spurting vegetable growth could fool anyone. Even our friend Holyoake, the astute longtime weather observer, describes on June 17th to August 17th as uniformly fine. In fact, he wrote in a confident hand that the crop outlook was better than could have been anticipated. But then the cold struck again. On August 21st, 1816, Holyoake wrote in a tenser hand, recording the frosts and snows that killed off the meager bean and corn crop. The difference between August 17th and August 21st was like summer compared to winter. The fields were as empty and white as October," he said. This particular damaging frost affected areas from southern Canada to North Carolina. And cold struck again on September 11th, 1816, and people tended fields as if they were dressed for December weather. In an age characterized by backbreaking labor, the poverty year, as 1816 was called by some, was a harrowing ordeal. Finally, Thomas Jefferson. From his Monticello home in Virginia, Thomas Jefferson, who also recorded the severe weather of 1816 in his weather diary. He was just one of many observers who recorded unusually cold weather during the summer of 1816. Strange weather was not confined to eastern North America. Bad weather was recorded all over the globe. Now let's talk about this year. Okay, we're going to talk about this year without a summer. Well, you'll find out that it's really not the worst summer ever, and I'm going to read some temperatures here. The following states had very, very cold summers. North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Much below normal were recorded summers this summer in Montana, Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas, Arkansas, Tennessee, Alabama, Kentucky, West Virginia, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, and Massachusetts. So we were below normal. Near normal, Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut. I want to throw in Rhode Island as below normal as well. New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Utah, Idaho, and Nevada. Above normal, meaning they were hotter than usual summers, we had Louisiana, Arizona, New Mexico, California, and Oregon. And there was record warmth in Washington State. I was out there during 100-degree temperatures in July, Texas and Florida. So you can see that there are some very cold periods in the United States this past summer, but there are some normal ones and above average. So just some data points. The Northeast region had its eighth wettest June through August summer on record. Okay. By contrast, the South, Southeast, and Southwest regions were drier than average. Arizona had its third driest summer, while both South Carolina and Georgia had their sixth driest summer. There were more than 300 low-temperature records set, counting daily highs and lows, set across the states in the Midwest during the last 2 days of August. For the 2009 summer, the average temperature of 71.7 degrees Fahrenheit was 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit below the 20th century average. The 2008 average temperature was 72.7 degrees Fahrenheit, so you have a 1 degree difference in 1 year for an average temperature. That's a lot. A recurring upper-level trough held the June-August temperatures down in the central states, while Michigan experienced its fifth, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and South Dakota their seventh, Nebraska its eighth, and Iowa its ninth coolest summer. By contrast, Florida had its fourth warmest summer, while Washington and Texas experienced their eighth and ninth warmest summers, respectively. The Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota regions experienced its sixth coolest summer on record, and only the Northwest averaged above normal temperatures. So, back to the sunspots, and we'll close here. Scientists have recently reconstructed this weak magnetic activity by measuring various chemical isotopes in tree rings. For example, matching them to weather and temperature oddities. Cosmic rays transmute nitrogen-14 in Earth's upper atmosphere, creating the radioactive isotope carbon-14. In the 1970s, solar astronomer John Eddy of the High Altitude Observatory in Boulder, Colorado, showed that carbon-14 concentration in annual tree growth rings is higher when fewer sunspots blemish the sun's surface. So in other words, this stunts the growth of trees. And carbon-14, basically the strong magnetic activity in the sun is passed on to solar wind, a stream of protons and helium nuclei flowing outward from the sun at a high speed. The strong magnetic field in the solar wind shields the Earth from cosmic rays, but because fewer cosmic rays collide with Earth, less carbon-14 forms in the atmosphere and make more carbon-14. So basically, when solar magnetism is weak, more galactic cosmic rays reach Earth, which stunts the growth of trees. Here's my warning. We'll close here, and then we're going to have an open discussion period. This is what I predict. Sunlight reaching the Earth is gradually diminishing due to pollution particles aloft. A study of sunlight was underway in the United States when the 9/11 attacks took place on September 11, 2001. With air traffic grounded over the next few days, scientists noticed a 20% increase in sunlight and water evaporation rates during 3 days of clear skies. This phenomena is known as global dimming. So in other words, without all those aircraft aloft with their contrails deflecting the sunlight back into outer space, they noticed that there was a 20% increase in sunlight. So when I hear the arguments of global warming on one side, where they twist the facts, and then the people that deny that we're polluting it, the industrialists who said there's no such thing as global warming, well, I think both schools are wrong. I've always thought that global warming was a precursor to global cooling. I believe, unless we do something right now, air pollution will one day block out the sun and quickly bring on a deadly cooling period causing starvation and disease. This phenomena, I believe, will be exacerbated when people begin burning items in their fireplaces to stay warm. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, here's my axiom. If we stop global warming, we can halt global dimming, which will prevent global cooling. And that's my lecture for you this morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. I want to talk to you about your personal recollections. Here's where I get, you give back to me, where I get to talk to you about living history. Some of you have been through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and I wanted to ask you, let's go around the table, if you remember
a summer? First of all, if you've lived in this area for all your life or in New England, do you remember a summer this bad, a bad June like that, and a really lousy July? Let's start with you, Harriet. Do you remember any weather to be this bad? Because people are reporting terrible gardens throughout New England, terrible harvests. They're blaming it on the soil. They're blaming it on themselves. They're blaming it on the rain, but it's just due to a lack of sunlight. Do you have any recollections of a bad cold summer like this summer, Harriet?
I don't remember any. I just have a little bit of a garden. And my garden, what they visited, was terrible this year. It just didn't want to grow. And I took the same care of it that I have since I lost my sight. But it just was very frustrating. And I thought it was a terrible summer. I thought it was one of the worst, probably the worst, that I remember since I grew up. I don't remember as a kid that any summer was bad. Every summer was wonderful.
Sure.
No school.
Yeah, and you wouldn't remember that. Your parents would have been probably grumbling about that, saying, this is the worst summer but you don't have that. Now, is your garden exposed to a lot of sunlight?
It is.
That's frightening. Yes. Now, I have a garden, well, it's not a garden, it's a collection of weeds. But I counted 44 corn stalks, and I got one corner of ear about the size of your hand. I planted beans, and beans can grow anywhere. Well, not my beans. They never got over a foot tall. Our tomato plants, They did well. They did harvest some tomatoes. Our carrots, we couldn't get carrots bigger than probably your thumb. What else? Radishes, nothing. Bust, nothing. The spices grew well. But I didn't have good sunlight because we have shady trees. But you had good sunlight, and I'm hearing from people all over New England, it was a terrible harvest. What about, your first name is?
Mary.
Mary, what about you? What are your recollections, and how was your garden?
Chemicals, I guess, that kill them. But I wasn't thinking of cold, I was thinking of heat. There was one summer, probably in the 40s, where there were about 12 or 14 days of terrible heat and humidity. So much so that I've never forgotten. I don't know, that used to be. We used to have what we call line storms here on the 15th of October and the 15th of May. Everybody got their boats up before that, and they wouldn't put them in until after the 15th because the storms would come, trash the beaches, throw big, huge boats on rocks. And ever since the atomic explosions, the whole thing is erratic. Get storms any old time.
Well, I talked about that curtain around the Earth of the of our magnetic bubble,
uh-huh.
And certainly, due to atomic explosions, that magnetic bubble was disrupted. Now, I can't give you any accurate measurements as to, and whether that directly affected the weather patterns, as I just mentioned this morning. If you look at the solar magnetic activity on the sun, it certainly does influence weather patterns on Earth. So perhaps there is an indirect correlation there between the atomic testing, which went on from 1945 through the 50s, even into the 60s after they promised they'd stop. Then the Soviets were doing, the Chinese, into the 70s. So that summer that you were talking about, I want to say 1944, that was during the year of the Bull Halsey hurricane, where he took the fleet into a typhoon. There were some hot days in 44. Is that the year you're thinking about, or you're thinking 1947, which is also a hot year?
Well, I can't pinpoint. I just think of it as the 40s.
The 40s were very hot, though.
The circumstances of my life were to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about the very extreme storms they had during the war out in Okinawa?
Yes. Yes, and then they had the Atlantic hurricane. The Great Atlantic Hurricane struck here in 1944 as well. So that's why I'm pinpointing 1944.
Yeah, I don't remember that too much. I remember the 38 one.
Oh, sure, GH-38. Oh, I have a lecture on that. Maybe one day I'll give you that lecture because I have a wonderful lecture. May I ask your opinions and your first name, please?
Well, Mary.
Mary, what about your recollections and
well,
what are your thoughts?
I,
Okay.
That summer was brutal.
Okay.
It was, I can remember, so hot that even at night, it just, the temperature never seemed to, you know, to cool off. People were sleeping over in Devereaux Beach, and we had a back porch all screened in, and I brought home an aunt of mine who was crippled, and I set up a bed for her out there because where she was living was so bad, so that she could sleep out there. That was her best, she said, that was her best summer because it was so cool where we were. But, oh, that was in 1949.
49, interesting.
49.
Brutal.
Yeah, it was. Very hot. August especially.
Yeah. May I ask you now, just recollections, do you remember a miserable June or July throughout your childhood?
It seems to me in the last two or three years, we really haven't had much of a spring. And I love spring. I mean, May, June.
Yes.
In the last two or three years, I can't say that we've had really much of a spring. We'd go from that very cool weather right into warm weather.
Yep. Yep.
You know, it wasn't, as I remember as a kid, May, I can remember Memorial Day would be beautiful. We'd go to the beach.
We're becoming bi-seasonal.
I spent a lot of time in June at the beach, but in the last two or three years, no. Mm. Very cool.
Mm. Mm. And what about your recollections?
Bye. I don't know, but years ago, excuse me, I have a father as well. My mother used to plant tomatoes and all this stuff, and this and that, and I don't remember, that's the only thing I do remember. I don't remember what year it was, but it was beautiful. That, you know, if you want to, any vegetable she had, very, very nice.
That's okay. Don't worry about this. And what about you?
Me?
Your first name is?
Joanne.
Hey, Joanne.
You know, I don't even remember the weathers other year than this. But this summer, I have been home because I know in June, it was like dark. It was not sunny or anything. And then I was in the hospital, and when I came home, I know it was nice and warm, but I wasn't out that much. Then all of a sudden, it's back and forth. You have hot days, cold days. It's like, it doesn't seem, oh, this is June. Now it's July and August. It's so hot. But yeah, it's been cold and, hot that you've had fans on or things like that, but it just changed. You don't know from day after day what it is. It's like, I don't know. I don't know anymore what, you know, from day after day, what the weather's going to be, because you just don't know anymore.
When you have pollution particles in the upper atmosphere, what tend to form around the particles? Clouds. More pollution, more clouds. And then if you have the finer pollution that goes up into the stratosphere, the upper levels of our atmosphere, that's doing a number on sunlight, deflecting it back into outer space. Before, this global warming phenomena, which I've always said is temporary, and enjoy the halcyon days of double harvests, you know, and football-sized tomatoes, it's always a precursor to global cooling. Now, I believe Mother Earth, Gaia, could shake off the human being like a bad case of the fleas if she wanted to. And one way she does naturally to cool herself down is to emit volcanoes. If you look out throughout the Earth's history, 2 million years, she shoots off volcanoes to cool herself down. Now, that's why whenever I hear volcanoes erupting, I get very, very nervous. Because right now, in the spring, in 2009, we are at a sunspot minimum, as I mentioned. And as soon as that sun becomes active, you're going to see auroras, you're going to see some activity. And right now, it's just cooler, but you're going to see dramatic change in the weather. I'm talking severity of storms. Severity of wind. As soon as that sun starts cranking it up and we get into what I mentioned as solar cycle 24. So we are on the precipice of a monumental change in our weather, I believe. And it's artificially induced, and it's induced by the lack of solar magnetic activity. And if Mother Earth decides to shoot off her volcanoes in succession, as she did in 18, 12, 13, 14, and 15, we're in big, big trouble. Because people are finding now in New England that their harvests, I don't know the percentage number, I'm going to guess that their harvest is down 30%. You're going to hear those numbers very shortly. That's provided they don't get a killing frost. They're trying to eke out every last day. Like we've had some beautiful weather in September. September is always a classic New England month, and I look for that to continue. And I look for October to have some warm days, but as you mentioned, winter should come on strong. So we're having protracted winter. I told my wife, March is a winter month. You can't debate that with me. And I'm going to lobby that April's a winter month, too. So may I ask you, that we're going around the table again, and what are your recollections and thoughts?
My recollection is, you know, when you're a little kid, you don't really pay too much attention to the weather when you're very small. But around 7 or 8, spring was spring. You know, people worked in their gardens. The grass got greener. The flowers started to come up. And then summer came. And this is when I was like 8 up until my middle to late teens. And this is how I noticed the weather to be for me. Okay? The spring came. The flowers came. People started their gardens. You know, and then summers were hot. And we didn't have air conditioning in our house, you know, like they do today. We didn't have all those modern conveniences. Summer was hot. And then fall came, and fall was beautiful. The end of the life of the flowers and the vegetables and stuff, they would flourish and then they would die because that's the way it was supposed to be. And then winter came, and winter was cold. Now things start to change. As I get older, I realize that summers aren't hot anymore. And what happened to spring? I mean, the grass started turning green in the summer, in the June months, instead of in April and May, you know. That's what I noticed. But I think part of it has to do with all this oil drilling they're doing. They're going right to the core of the earth. They're going to the mountains and they're scraping all the shale oil off. You know, the more they damage our earth, the more things change. And like you said, they have planes in the sky more and more. People now own their own private jets. You've got even more planes in the sky. So they're disrupting the clouds. You know, so that's what I think. I think the reason everything is changing in our environment is because of all the things we're doing to the earth in the name of progress.
Yeah, right. In the name of profit is what you're saying.
Well, but, exactly. Profit, which, well, it's progress, and along with progress comes profit.
Right. I'm going to make a prediction right now, just to, before I get on my list, that the stock market's going to go down 1,000 points within the next 6 weeks. Remember that I told you that. October's always been a notorious year for stock market crashes. Let me just talk about lead emissions. Lead emissions, when we went from leaded gasoline to unleaded gasoline, and pollution controls and the Environmental Protection Agency stepped up, we reduced in the 1970s, where we were horribly polluting Boston Harbor, Charles River, emitting pollutants into the atmosphere. We reduced it by 80%, okay, and by the 1990s we reduced lead emissions. But meanwhile, and you mentioned about there's three times as many automobiles on the road today since 1979. That's due to the industrialization of Southeast Asia, namely China, Japan, and India. And they're entitled to the Western culture just as much as we are. There's three times as many commercial flights as there were 20 years ago. And again, they're streaming these clouds in the upper atmosphere. And as you mentioned, some of these commercial flights going cross-country have 6 people on them. So eventually, they have to determine that this, and lights are on 24/7. All these car dealerships, you can see them from outer space, the Automile in Norwood. Why do you have to have your electricity on?
But that's in the United States. A lot of countries aren't as fortunate as the United States either.
That's right. But they like a taste of the Western civilization, right. and
they like
demand.
They like a taste of progress, and they like a taste of the money that goes along with it.
Sure. But what we have to do individually is reduce our own carbon footprint. And what we all have to do is make a concerted effort to recycle and to start being a disposable society. The scourge on pollution due to these plastic water bottles, people selling tap water, and we all fell for it. We bought tap water when we could have just gotten it out of our own sink. May I ask you, your first name is?
Teresa.
Hey, Teresa. Well, what are your thoughts, and just if you could just tell me what your feelings are on the weather?
I mean, the weather has changed. The world's changed. So what are you going to do? You're going to have to go along with what we got and what's coming. Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, What about the desolation of the rainforests in the Amazon and the taiga in the Soviet? These are the lungs of the earth. This is what takes out and scrubs the earth's atmosphere, replaces CO2 with oxygen and vice versa. And as we take the trees down, we're losing our lungs. But
we're losing everything.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for having me here today. I really enjoyed speaking to you.
I want to offer you.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Do you put your talks on tape?
Yes.
Do you?
Yes.
Do you sell them?
No, you can listen to them on at www.ushistory.me.
And this is the banana.
Could you guys say that again?
www.ushistory.me.
And I'll give you
just remember me and U.S. history.
All right, huh?